We hope this explanation of God's Word enriches your life. To help you understand the audience for this talk, we suggest you read the context material on the About Us page. Please read also our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material from philipjensen.com. This talk was recorded at the lunchtime campus Bible study, where it was delivered for university students.
Well, we're glad to see you here at the beginning of this year, and these outlines. We had these question comment cards, which we'll collect at the end, so you might be jotting down any questions that come to your mind on the way through, so that you'll be ready, because there won't be much time at the end, my guess is, when we'll be able to write more comments or questions and drop them in at the boxes at the doors on the way out. I presume there's tea and coffee being served outside down here, so if you go out that way, it's the easiest way to avoid clash and conflict with the next lecture class coming in. But at each of the doors will be people with those elegant plastic buckets, and we can collect up the cards and the comments there so that we can partly hear the feedback, so that partly have the opportunity of being able to answer some of the questions, if possible, for next time. The outline, for those of you who are newcomers amongst us, on the yellow sheet there, each of the topics as I go, I'll refer to them on the way through using those particular words. That we are going to start off looking at the faith in the age of sceptical credulity, but that'll come in a moment or two. Well, it might as well come now. It'll do as good as any time, won't it? You see, it's a very strange phase of history we're in. I don't know if this is true of other periods of history, I just know it's true of our own. That we live with this combination of scepticism and credulity. And the two are opposites, and you wouldn't expect that we could ever live with both of them at the same time, but in our crazy society, that seems to be the kind of thing that we're doing. I just picked out Macquarie Dictionary definitions. Here's one on skeptic and scepticism. Well, it's not one, it's six different ones. One who questions the validity or authenticity of something purporting to be knowledge. One who mistrusts and who maintains a doubting, pessimistic attitude towards people, plans, ideas. Now, it has specific uses, such as in Christianity, one who doubts the truth of the Christian religion or important elements of it, or philosophically, because there was an ancient Greek school called the Skeptics, and they maintained that real knowledge of things is impossible. So you can go to the much more persistent form, and then there's the adjective form and so on. The first two definitions, though, are the broad meanings of the word. Those who question the validity and authenticity of something purporting to be knowledge. One who mistrusts and who maintains a doubting, pessimistic attitude towards people, plans, ideas. Now, scepticism is a wonderful thing. It is university training, is to train you into be sceptical. That you will not just accept everything everybody tells you. That you stop and query, you question, you doubt, you test the hypothesis, you try to find faults in what is being said, so that you develop this capacity for critical thinking, which will enable you to look beyond the kind of salesman rhetorics and the politicians and their attempts to sell you on everything. It's a very valuable and useful thing. But it does have a problem to it. It's the problem under definition four of the philosophical school. That is, you cannot actually come to a knowledge of anything by scepticism. It is wholly negative. Now, there is a place for that negativity, a very important place. But you've got to remember that that's not the end of the story. Because if that is the end of the story, you can only know nothing. Socrates wasn't one of the schools of the skeptics, although effectively he was. Socrates claimed to know one thing which put him ahead of everybody else. He said, the one thing I know that nobody else knows is that I know nothing. Everyone else thinks they know something, which means they've got one thing wrong, whereas I've got one thing and only one thing, and that thing is right, namely, I know nothing. On the basis of this scepticism, this knowledge that he knew nothing, he then dismantled all his opponents in a series of dialogues. And so people would come forward and put forward their ideas about life or virtue. And Socrates, knowing that the man didn't know anything, would gently and humorously pull apart their arguments and to show them that they really didn't know what virtue was, they really didn't know what good was, they really didn't know anything. And so Socrates always comes out as the winner in all the dialogues. He comes out as the clever man, the profound man, the highly intelligent man. But Socrates knows nothing. At the end of the day, Socrates can tell you nothing other than what's wrong with everybody else. But he can't actually put forward any information for you because he knows nothing. It looks very learned, But it is wholly negative, and indeed it's unlivable, because you can't live without trusting other people. The other day I had three meals in the day, very strange and a bizarre thing. I started with my wife's muesli. I am very middle-aged now. I then moved on to lunch at McDonald's and tea at the Pizza Hut. It's a kind of well-rounded view of life, so to speak. Now, each of those meals required an enormous amount of trust, didn't it? You see, any one of them, the people could have had dirty hands, they could have used shoddy materials, it could be kangaroo meat instead of prime beef, it could be... I trust them. You may say, that's a stupidity, Philip, but I'm here to tell the story. It wasn't wrong this time. I trust them. You say, but you didn't trust your wife. Oh, most of all, I trusted my wife. After all, where do most murders occur? At home, between spouses. What has she been putting in the muesli? She could be just putting just traces of arsenic. I am beginning to lose my hair, I've noticed. My fingernails, I keep on breaking. I mean, I trust her, and so I eat her muesli. Very kindly, some people brought me down a drink of water here to have. Well, I'm happy to have the drink of water, but it could be an anti-Christian, couldn't it, that's actually slipped in slivers of glass in this water, couldn't it? So that when I drink it, it just slash all the insides of my throat. Now, see, the sceptic asks that kind of question. You'll die of thirst if you're a sceptic. You'll die of hunger if you're a sceptic. You see, it's very good to ask the questions, but you've got to realise the limitations of scepticism. And it's a very profound limitation. It means that you'll never know anything. On the other hand, there's credulity, the opposite of it. I realised afterwards, I should have used the word gullibility, because most people know what gullibility means, but of course, they've taken the word gullibility out of the Macquarie Dictionary, haven't they? So, I had to use credulity. If you haven't got that one, it's a worry. But never mind. Think about it. And whatever you do, don't ask anybody. Won't work. So that's a credulity. That is a disposition arising from weakness or ignorance to believe too readily. Or a credulous person is one who is ready or disposed to believe, especially on weak or insufficient evidence. It's the exact opposite of a sceptic. The sceptic won't believe anything because he's always got a doubt. The credulous person will believe everything or anything that's going. And while we've got a society full of sceptics, we've also got a society full of credulous people who believe anything. Have you seen what they do with politicians? Our politicians have told us that they lie. Our politicians have told us they can't govern the country without telling us lies. And yet our populace keeps on believing what the politicians are telling them. Now that is credulity. That is an incredible thing. We all know the advertisers are telling lies. And yet advertising works. People go out and buy the things they see advertised, even though we know advertisers are telling lies all the time. And in the religious circles, have you ever looked into what Shirley MacLaine believes? She believes the most weird, bizarre, strange, peculiar, without any evidence, nonsense. In fact, one interviewer actually asked her, is there anything, Miss MacLaine, that you do not believe in? It really is just total credulity. It's gullibility that people go on with. Now, credulity has tremendous strength because credulous people are nice people. They're easy to live with because they trust you all the time. And you can tease them a lot and make fun of them as well. The danger of being a credulous person is that you believe lies, that you get conned, that you live a life of falsehood and stupidity. Now, what of faith? Christian faith. Is it skepticism or is it credulity? Well, here's the nine of the definitions from Macquarie Dictionary. Confidence or trust in a person or thing. That is what I think Christians mean by the word faith. Though non-Christians generally think we mean definition number two. Belief which is not based on proof. The belief which is not based on proof is credulity. That's not faith. That's being credulous. That's being gullible. Three, belief in things, doctrines or teachings of religions, and the others are fairly neutral. They're down in number eight is a very fine theological definition, which I would have thought Martin Luther would have been proud of. That trust in God and in his promises as made through Christ by which man is justified or saved, that is actually what Christians mean by the word faith. But, of course, you need the rest of the dictionary to understand what it means. So, generally, you go to number one, and Christians believe in number one. That is, confidence or trust in a person or thing. which is neither scepticism nor credulity. It's neither, is it? Because you can actually test out this person, like a skeptic can test out, and yet it's not the skeptic because you do believe. And so it's neither scepticism nor credulity. Now, why am I just starting off with these word games? Well, because of today's passage in Luke chapter 1, verses 1 to 4, which I hope you have open in front of you. But this passage introduces us to divine history. History, make no mistake about it, but history that it involves and includes God, and therefore is quite different to the history you'll learn elsewhere on this university campus. Because by and large, in the humanities of our campus here, the subject of God has been excluded a priori. It's excluded before the discussion starts. You're not allowed to introduce God into the discussion. Now try it out in a tutorial or a seminar anytime you like, in general studies, you know, and people ask you, you know, what was the causes of the Rum Rebellion? Just say, well, I think the real cause is that man is rebellious against God. The tutor is all well trained in how to be positive and affirmative to everybody and will turn to you and say, that's a very interesting idea. Has anybody else got some idea they'd like to share with the class at this stage? But which being interpreted means, for those who are uninitiated, you blithering idiot, what a stupid idea that is. But we never say that these days, we just actually treat you as if you don't exist, because we treat God as if God doesn't exist. And so we teach history without any reference to God, but Luke doesn't do that. Luke writes history, but it's history that is divine history, that actually includes, because he's not closed-minded like the modern secularist, he's open-minded to include the possibilities of God involved in the events of humans. But the author tells us that he is writing history. Notice how he starts off about other documents. See, other people have taken to write these things. I'm not the first to write. He's not claiming to be a unique source about Jesus and what he's going to write about. There are other sources as well, other sources known to him. Now, much study has gone into the sources and the studies of other sources in the New Testament era. It is quite clear that Matthew's Gospel, Mark's Gospel, and Luke's Gospel have an enormous amount in common that is more than accidental, and places their word for word with each other, and somebody has borrowed from somebody. Well, Luke tells us that he's got references to other sources, and after about 100 years of fairly nitpicking study, most of the academic world has come to the conclusion that Mark is the first gospel, and that Matthew and Luke both had access to Mark, as well as to other sources as well. Now, as a process of this nitpicking, going through word by word of seeing who's borrowing from whom and who's changing which and which one is dependent upon the other, as a process of this kind of study, we've come to see something else. That is, how carefully Luke has used his sources. Once you come to see that he has used Mark, you can then say, well, now, did he distort Mark? Did he change Mark? Did he improve the story? There's a very interesting book which is selling around about. It's outside near the tea and coffee area. It's down the chaplaincy by Paul Barnett on Is the New Testament History? Paul Barnett did his PhD at London University in first century Jewish messianic movement. So he's an expert in first century Jewish history. And he's written this book about the historical reliability, validity of the New Testament. In it, he refers to much of these researchers. For example, the researchers of Hoskins and Davies, two English scholars, who after an exhaustive comparison of Matthew and Luke's Gospel and the way they used Mark, wrote, the authors of the two later Gospels are concerned for their Greek readers. They add, in order to make clear what Jesus demands of his disciples. They simplify in order to avoid crude misunderstandings. They omit what appears to be trivial and unnecessary. They order and arrange the tradition in order that it may be the more easily read in public or in private. And they improve the grammar and style in order that their intelligent readers may not be unreasonably provoked. As we check their use of Mark, we find that Matthew and Luke are responsible scribes who do not exaggerate the material at their disposal. You see, we have it. We have his documents, and we have the documents upon which he relied, and we can see how he treated his documents, and he does not exaggerate. Fixes up the grammar, puts the stories in slightly different order, simplifies what is being said, but not exaggerates. So the conclusion, but in the whole of this process, writes Dr. Barnett, in the whole of this process of editing, they nowhere heighten Mark's tremendous conception of Jesus. No deifying of a prophet or a mere preacher of righteousness can be detected. He does not improve the story while he is recounting it. So here is a man who's writing out of documents, but not only documents, also traditions. the things, verse 1, that have been handed down amongst us, that have been fulfilled amongst us, verse 2, just as they were handed down to us. Traditions not that are old traditions, but things that were fulfilled amongst us and are now handed down to us by eyewitnesses. That is, Luke is in touch with the first generation. He's been taught by the first generation of Christians. And not just one eyewitness, it's plural eyewitnesses. And so he has access to both written history and oral history. Now, that is the best way of having access to history. It's very hard to write a history of the Bosnian-Serbian war at the moment because the dust hasn't settled. We can't see who's done what or where. It's very hard to write a history of the Napoleonic Wars because there's no one around who can fix up and tell us, no, no, you've got it wrong. But we are in an ideal position to write the history of the Second World War because there's still enough people around who can remember what it was like, who can tell us how much a tram ride was at the time and where the tram routes went, and they can tell us the details that are left out of the chronicles of the big, and you can fill in all the details against the big story that has been given to us in the documents that are available. And so I've read some of Winston Churchill's history of the Second World War, so I've talked to my father and my uncles and my aunts, and they've filled in the details that you can't get in a book, and so you can really study that period of history. But that's the position that Luke was in. The documents are there and the eyewitnesses are there. Oral and written history is available to me. And from these sources, Luke, who's not one of the eyewitnesses himself, it would indicate from this, because he wasn't around from John the Baptist day, we know, has first-hand information. It's not remote. It's not a long way away. And for his own part, he says, I myself have carefully investigated. That is, I haven't just relied on the documents and the traditions or the eyewitnesses. I've actually gone and investigated what it was on about, what has been said. Carefully investigated, he claims. G.B. Caird is a man, he's just retired now. He had wrote this in his commentary on Luke's Gospel. The account we have given of Luke's literary procedure consists entirely of deductions drawn from a careful study of his Gospel. But it coincides almost exactly with what he himself has to tell us in his prologue. As far as the Gospel is concerned, Luke has made good his claim to be a trustworthy historian, provided that we do not make the blunder of judging him by the canons of modern scientific historiography. Leave it there, but you see, Caird is a great scholar. He got firsts in classics in Cambridge, he got his DPhil from Oxford, he wound up as a professor, as a lecturer in Oxford University in first century classics. He is an expert in this field. He just done a literary examination of Luke's Gospel, and he works out from nothing other than Luke's Gospel his literary procedure, how he went about his business. And he concludes that Luke is just the same kind of historian that Luke says he is, that he did what this prologue, what these first four verses say. In every sense he's a historian, except in the modern sense. The modern sense of scientific historiography, which says you're not allowed to refer to God. You're not allowed to refer to anything miraculous. Anything miraculous, anything that refers to God, anything that refers to angels, anything that refers to the supernatural, must be let out of Manning Clark's A Short History of Australia. That's out. Now, if you've got to be like that to be a historian, he's not a historian. But if you allow, if you've got an open mind that allows the possibility of the other world, then in every sense of the word, he's a historian from the way in which he has operated in writing this account. And notice that it's not just some events, but everything that he has investigated. From the beginning, he has investigated. And so we have accounts in Luke's Gospel of the birth of Jesus and Mary and John the Baptist's birth, which we don't have in the other Gospels, which is why Luke's read around Christmas time so much. And so here is his goal in verse 3-4. He says, my goal, therefore, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, it seemed good also to me to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things that you have been taught. What's he doing? He's writing an orderly account. See, history is not just research. History is also writing. It's different to most research as a subject history, because the key to history is not so much finding out the information, but organising it and selecting it and presenting it. You see, you can't write a history of everything, because a history of everything would fill the whole universe and would take forever to read, because every detail of life would have to be mentioned. She scratched her nose. She touched her glasses. She put her hand back down. The ant climbed up her pen. The ant turned around 35 degrees left. The ant then... every detail would have to be presented, which it's unreadable, mercifully. And no one's trying to do it. You can't. So you're going to have to select and say, ants climbing up and down pens, they're unimportant. Leave them out. Scratching the nose, unimportant. Leave that out. Touching the glasses, unimportant. Leave that out. Pulling the trigger, we'll leave that one in. That sounds. Who did she shoot at the time? That sounds like an important one. And so you make selections, but what is the basis of the selection? The basis of the selection is what the historian thinks is important or unimportant. Modern secularists think God is unimportant, so he's left out. That's just a decision they've made a priori. It's got nothing to do with whether God was involved or not. They just think that is an unimportant thing. We can leave that out. We even leave out the selection. They even leave out the people who do believe in God or don't believe in God. It's unimportant to them, so they leave it out. Now, what Luke has done, he said, I've collected up the information and presenting it in an orderly fashion so that you, Theophilus, may know of a certainty the things that you were taught. That is his aim. But before I talk about that purpose more, let's notice that it is divine history we're talking of. And give a little defence for the divine history. Because Luke is not saying that what happened is accidental. He is saying it was purposeful. Now, one of the problems for those who believe the whole universe is accidental is that everything in the universe is accidental as well. And so you can never select events and present them in an orderly fashion on the basis of some grand plan or scheme or purpose. Because everything ultimately is an accident bumping into other accidents. All events are random events. They all happen. And so you just gather up the things that you are interested in personally. And so you can write a history of Australia just paying attention to black whales. Or you can write a history of Australia just paying attention to Irish drunks. Or you can write it. And it's just an expression of what is of interest to the historian, because black whales and Irish drunks are about as irrelevant accidents as any other accidents that could take place. You could write the whole history of Australia by just writing the history of the University of New South Wales and say this is the cosmos, this is kind of a little impression of everything that is happening. You can write a history any way you like, you see, when everything is an accident. When everything just... But that's not what he's talking about. Look what he says in verse 1. Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have not just happened, that have been fulfilled amongst us. Funny word, that one, isn't it? What is it that has been fulfilled? We see, believer in God, he knows that God is supervising history, that history has a beginning and has an end, and that God is working his great purposes out. And God has predicted in the Old Testament, through his prophets, God has predicted what is going to happen. And what Luke says is, I'm now going to tell you what has been fulfilled, what God promised that has now taken place. And so it is written from the perspective of a divine view of history. It wasn't just an accident. It wasn't just a happening. It was a fulfillment of God's plans. It was a fulfillment of God's prophecies. So I'm outlining to you what has been fulfilled of recent times amongst us. And so he is spelling out for you the divine view from the beginning, which is why the eyewitnesses are described, and I hope all the skeptics amongst you notice this at the end of verse 2, the eyewitnesses are described as the servants of the word. Because the skeptics immediately will then say, ah, the eyewitnesses are biased. You're only getting it from the Christians. Now, a biased eyewitness, what use is a biased eyewitness? Because they're servants of God, these ones, servants of the word, won't they be biased and therefore, well, my friends, bias is an inevitable. And good historians know that bias is there, and what good historians really like is to know what the bias is. You see, it's gullibility that wants an unbiased account. There is no unbiased account of anything. Everyone's biased. You see, take the Sydney Morning Herald and the Tribune. I don't know whether the Tribune's published anymore. I've been asking the last couple of days and no one's been able to tell me. The Tribune for 60 years was the publication of the Communist Party here in Australia. I don't know if it's still published. I haven't seen it around lately. But now the Sydney Morning Herald pretends to be an unbiased newspaper, whereas the Tribune blatantly is a biased newspaper. It is the publication, the official publication of the Communist Party I can't remember its name because the Communist Party kept on splitting and different people took over the Tribune, but the Communist Party. Now, which paper gives you a more readable view of reality? Which one enables you to understand reality more clearly? The Sydney Morning Herald or the Tribune? Well, obviously, the Tribune. Obviously. You see, when the Tribune says Joseph Stalin was the greatest man on the earth, when the Tribune says Ronald Reagan is a dreadful pig, right? Well, then you read it and you say, well, of course the Tribune would say that. They're communists. They're anti-capitalists. But when the Sydney Morning Herald says to you, Joseph Stalin is the greatest man who ever lived, you say, well, that's an unbiased account? I mean, who wrote that? You don't know, especially if it's the editorial. You see, the man who wrote it could be a communist, couldn't he? He could be moonlighting, you know, the second job from the Communist Party newspaper. You don't know. The editor who's let it through, he could be a communist. You don't know. You don't know what the bias of the Sydney Morning Herald is. And because you don't know what the bias of the Sydney Morning Herald is, you've got no way of evaluating the kind of comment they're making. Knowing the bias of the speaker is a very important way of being able to read and listen and think critically. I hope you're under no misapprehension at all. I'm a Christian. I'm glad to be Christian, quite openly proud to be a Christian, pleased to be a Christian, and very thankful that I'm a Christian. So as you sit there listening, you're not, when I speak about Christianity, I presume you're saying, yes, well, of course, he would say that. He's pro-Christian, isn't he? That's part of being a critical listener. You should be thinking like that. But you see how easy it is to do that with me because I am open and front about my bias. How hard it is for many of the lecturers you hear from the General Studies Department who never let you know what their bias is, who won't tell you what their background is in terms of their rejection of Christianity or their acceptance of it or their Marxism or their... You don't know where they're coming from because they're not upfront always about where they're coming from. Very much harder to listen and evaluate them. Well, Luke tells you where his eyewitnesses are coming from. And you say, but that's still no good. I mean, an eyewitness says, Jesus rose from the dead. I know he's a Christian, so therefore I don't know whether I can believe it or not. At this point, Christians are damned if you do and damned if you don't. It's like censorship. Now, when Christians oppose censorship, we don't want women being degraded in public portrayals in the media. Right? We're opposed to that kind of view and the way in which it teaches men to think so negatively and appallingly about women. So we want to oppose it. We can never win the argument. As soon as I say that movie shouldn't be allowed, that book should be opposed, someone says to me, have you seen the movie? Have you read the book? Now I'm done as soon as they ask the question, aren't I? Done as a dinner. If I say, no, I haven't seen it, they say, well, how do you know it's degrading? If I say, yes, I have seen it, they say, well, were you degraded by it? Now if I say yes, they say, well, we're not going to listen to a degenerate like you. And if I say no, they say, well, it didn't degrade you, why will it degrade me? There's no way I can win, is there? And yet, you know the thing's degrading. But you can never prove it in that kind of argument because you're always biased one way or another. Well, it's like that with the Jesus and the resurrection, isn't it? A person sees Jesus risen from the dead, what's they going to do? Well, they're going to become a Christian. They become a Christian, they say, look, I saw Jesus risen from the dead. And people say, are you a Christian? You say, yes. You say, well, I can't believe you. What's he supposed to do? Not become a Christian. So he can go around the world and say, I saw Jesus rise from the dead and I'm not a Christian. And when he's told everybody, then become a Christian. So I told you when I was unbiased. How can you get unbiased witnesses of something like the resurrection from the dead? Where do you drum them up from? You see, the problem that is built into this kind of complaint about the servants of the word being the eyewitnesses, it's to a certain extent inevitable that the eyewitnesses will become the servants of this word, given the claims that are brought into the very word. Let me show you skepticism at work in the minds of the academics. See, here is a quotation from Josephus. I think there is a quotation from Josephus. About this time arose Jesus, a wise man, if indeed it be lawful to call him a man, for he was a doer of wonderful deeds and a teacher of men who gladly received the truth. He drew to himself many, both of the Jews and of the Gentiles, and he was the Christ. And when Pilate, on the indictment of the principal men among us, had condemned him to the cross, those who had loved him at the first did not cease to do so, for he appeared to them again alive on the third day.
the divine prophets having foretold these and 10,000 other wonderful things about him. And even to this day, the race of the Christians who are named from him has not died out. Now, what's so strange about that statement? Well, what's strange is that Josephus is a Jew. He's a Jew living between 60 and 90 AD. He's writing the history of the Jews for the Romans. And in his writing of the history of the Jews, I think we need to left on that one, brother, and keep this one off. In the history of the writing of the Jews, I can see they're eagerly working here. In the writing of the Jews, in the history of the Jews, Jesus is part of the history of the Jews, and so he includes it. But what is strange are some of the things he says. I mean, the first thing that you see there, about this time arose Jesus, a wise man, well, that's not particularly strange for a Jew to say that, although fairly complimentary. But the next bit, if indeed it be lawful to call him a man, well, why would a Jew doubt that he was a man? That sounds a bit suspicious. Now, listen to a great professor in England at the moment who's analysing this kind of literature. He says, a wise man, this doesn't seem to be a Christian description of Jesus. Josephus is probably civilising Jesus as he did John. If indeed it be lawful to call him a man, well, this on the other hand is almost certainly a Christian addition. One who was not a Christian would have no hesitation in calling Jesus a man. Or the next thing, a little bit there about from the word many down to, can you just point it out for us over here, from the word many down to the Gentiles, he drew himself many, both of the Jews and the Gentiles, to see it there. This is a Christian interpretation, or Josephus is writing out of his knowledge of the composition of the church. Or the bit, he was the Christ, the next phrase. Well, Professor Barrett says this must be a Christian interpolation. It is quite impossible to make Josephus' words, he was believed to be the Christ. That's a bad translation. He was the Christ is what Josephus wrote. How could a non-Christian Jew write he was the Christ? Couldn't have. Therefore, somebody must have tampered with the text later. Now, there's a problem with this. Every copy of Josephus we've got has the same text. We haven't got a text of Josephus with these words left out. We haven't got a copy of Josephus with someone penciling the words in. Every copy we've got has these words in it. So we have absolutely no evidence that Josephus did not write this. Every piece of evidence we've got is that he did write this. But the problem is, how could a Jew say he believed that Jesus was the Christ? You see the problem with bias here? In our scepticism, we have reached the point where it doesn't matter what is said, we won't believe it. When you say we must have someone who's not a Christian saying he rose from the dead. Josephus is not a Christian and he said he rose from the dead. Well, when you find a Jew who says Jesus rose from the dead, you say, well, that can't be true. Well, if it can't be true, why did you ask for it? Can't have it both ways, can you? You can't say you must have the non-Christian witness and at the same time, when he turns up, say, well, he witnessed it to it, therefore it can't be true. Someone must have fiddled the documents. I show you why it can be true. Do you think it can be true? See, I'm a critical thinker of the 20th century. I find it hard to believe too. And C.K. Barrett, he actually goes on to say, these words about the resurrection one, these words must have been written by a Christian. I'm a cynic and skeptic too. But let me unease you a little bit further. Here's a book by a man called Pincus Lapide, L-A-P-I-D-E, and Pincus, in case you want to name your children, P-I-N-C-H-A-S. And this little book was called The Resurrection of Jesus. It came out about 5 years or so ago. No, 83, 10 years ago. Right? Pincus Lapide, The Resurrection of Jesus. And in this book, he goes through the evidences about Jesus dying and rising from the dead, and this man comes to the conclusion that Jesus did rise from the dead, given the historical documents that are available today. What is extraordinary about that? This man is a Jewish rabbi with a PhD scholarships and postgraduate, postdoctoral scholarships in Jewish history. He was a Jewish rabbi and has now become a Christian as a result of finding Jesus rose from the dead. He still continues to be a Jewish rabbi to this very day. He is still anti-Christian. He is still opposed to Christianity. But he admits that on the historical evidences you have to come to the conclusion that Jesus did rise from the dead. So the very reason Professor Barrett would say that Josephus can't write this, namely, he's a Jew, Pincus Lapide demonstrates he could have written it because he's a Jew who's not a Christian and he believes that. It can happen. And he gives his reasons and arguments for it, which, well, that's another day. It is divine, and because it is divine, it has its certain biases, but its biases are up front and known to us. What's the purpose for which he writes? He writes to the excellent Theophilus. The word means God-lover. That's his name, means God-lover. We don't know whether it's a pseudonym or a title or something. He writes to him so that you might know the certainty of the things that you're being taught. He's had traditions handed down to him. He's been told the story of Jesus. Luke has gone and investigated the evidences and is writing the evidence so the man who has heard about it can know the certainty, so that he won't be just left as a victim of credulity, won't be just left having to believe what he's been taught, but the things that he's taught are things that you can investigate, find out about, and be persuaded that they are true. So here's the problem for the moderns, right? How will we respond to Christianity? You see, most moderns think they know something about Christianity, you know, Christmas, Easter, the Ten Commandments, the 12 Apostles, or was it the 12 Commandments and the 10 Apostles, or something like that. You can respond to Christianity with credulity. That's one response about it. My mother taught me that Christianity is true, therefore I'm a Christian. My mother taught me Christianity is not true, therefore I'm not a Christian. Both responses are just sheer credulity, aren't they? They're gullibility. I mean, they're lovely because you trust your mother, and I'm so glad you do. But they are irrational, because mothers do mislead children. All the mothers of this world cannot be correct. I want to be against mothers, especially if we're coming to Mother's Day, but frankly, that's the truth, isn't it? Or you can have the skeptic's response. Luke is biased. He wrote it for money or for fame or to win favour with the government and to con Theophilus, because Theophilus is a rich man and he's trying to get his money. I mean, you can always raise doubts, you can always raise scepticism, and the trouble is it's impossible to be unbiased. It's impossible to satisfy the skeptic's questions in the end, because the skeptic never knows anything ultimately. He only knows how to ask the next question, but never can find out any truth. Note the thought form of Luke, though. It's genuine Christianity. It's not credulity, and it's not scepticism. It's that credible supernaturalism, the open-mindedness that will say, I will look into it. I will look into it without excluding miracles, without excluding God, without excluding possibilities. I'll look into it. But it's not credulity. It's not, I'll just accept it. I'll ask the questions. I'll poke, I'll investigate. And as we start a university together, investigating is what I encourage you to research into this. Sir William Ramsay was a 19th century Englishman of great wealth who came persuaded by the Tubingans, the Germans, into believing that Luke and Acts were a second century fraud. It was very common in the 19th century. Ramsay wandered the Middle East looking for archaeology for a completely different reason. And as he investigated, he found out more and more evidence to show that Acts and Luke were written by a first century man who could only have been there at the time. Hands up those who can tell me whether Lismore has a city hall or a town hall. Hands up those who think it's a city hall. Hands up those who think Lismore has a town hall. Hands up those who do not know. So if you were writing a history of the North Coast, you wouldn't know which word to use, would you? Whether it's a city hall or a town hall. Hands up those who think Sydney's got a city hall. Hands up those who think Sydney's got a town hall. Hands up those who don't know. Welcome to Sydney. Now, it's the kind of minutia that only a person who's been there would know. Lismore, the little town, sorry, the marvellous rural centre. Lismore, the little town, has a city hall. Sydney, the great capital of the universe, it has a town hall. It's that kind of oddity that only the people who were there at the time would ever get straight. But William Ramsay discovered that's what Luke does all the time. He wrote, and I've now not got it in front of me, so I'll read it from there. I may fairly claim to have entered on this investigation without prejudice in favour of the conclusion which I shall now seek to justify to the reader. On the contrary, I began with a mind unfavourable to it, for the ingenuity and apparent completeness of the Tubingen theory had at one time quite convinced me. It did not then lie in my lines of life to investigate the subject minutely. So he didn't investigate the Tubingen theory, he just believed it. But more recently, I found myself brought into contact with the Book of Acts as an authority for the topography, antiquities, and societies of Asia Minor. It was gradually borne upon me that in various details the narrative showed marvellous truth. In fact, beginning with the fixed idea that the work was essentially a second century composition and never relying on it for its evidence as trustworthy for the first century conditions, I gradually came to find it a useful ally in some obscure and difficult investigations, and Ramsay, the anti-Christian, became a Christian for no other reason than investigating the historical accuracy of Luke, the writer of the Gospel and the Acts. Well, are you ready for the investigation? I hope you are for this term, this session. That you won't just accept Christianity because somebody's told you it's true, and you won't reject it because somebody's told that it's true. Why investigate this? Well, because it's like a bomb under the building. Because if it's true, the Jesus we're talking about is the one who made you, who died for you, and one day is going to judge you. It's not something to ignore. Now, if you've just come in late, can I encourage you to be filling out the name cards for us inside your things, as people, the rest, are just putting down their comment cards and getting the question or comment ready that they've got. But those who are latecomers, if you'll be dropping in your name cards as well as your comment cards, there's tea and coffee going to be served in a minute outside, down the front, and I'll close in prayer, shall I? Let's pray. We thank and praise you, Father, for your word, and we pray for integrity to investigate it, not with credulity, nor with total scepticism, but with honesty and openness. And we pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the talks on philipjensen.com. Please check our copyright page before recording or reproducing any material on philipjensen.com.